American taxpayers over $2.3 trillion. Thousands of American troops lost their lives, and many more were injured in the protracted military campaign that's been widely described as a fiasco. The war wreaked havoc on Afghanistan, with tens of thousands of civilians losing their lives or limbs. On August the 30th, the United States withdrew from Afghanistan after a terrible loss to the enemy it invaded Afghanistan to defeat. There is absolutely no doubt that the Afghan mission ended in failure. Afghanistan was the first country attacked by America as part of its so-called War on Terror, launched by former President George W. Bush. Almost none of the stated goals of the Afghan mission were ever fulfilled. In late September, America's highest-ranking general, Chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley, said during a Senate hearing that the U.S. pullout, with the Taliban back in power, is quote-unquote a strategic failure.
America's weakness has been exposed to the world. I mean, essentially, America's incompetence, its military weakness, its lack of foresight was exposed as a result of the chaotic pullout of Afghanistan. It was shown that America had no idea why it was there. It had no clear goals. It lacked the military means for subduing the Taliban. And all it could do was spread destruction. So that is essentially exposes the incredible weakness of the American empire.
Many Americans are still looking for answers. What brought their country to this part of the world? And what kept it fighting a futile war for two decades? Meanwhile, the U.S. is definitely not taking responsibility for the mess that it left behind in this volatile region as huge waves of Afghan refugees overwhelm neighboring countries and beyond. The United States has fought many wars during its history. Over the past decades, most U.S. military missions have been criticized for not going as planned. The Afghan mission became particularly notorious for lack of strategy and proper planning. U.S. lawmakers have launched a commission to study the Afghanistan fiasco. This week, the U.S. Congress voted to set up a commission to assess the failures during the 20-year war. The commission was part of an annual military package passed by the Senate on Wednesday after approval last week by the House of Representatives. The bipartisan Commission on Afghanistan will have 16 members. It faces a deadline to issue an initial report within a year of its first meeting, and a final report within 3 years. The legislation said, quote, "The commission shall conduct a comprehensive assessment of the war in Afghanistan and make recommendations to inform future operations with tactical and strategic lessons learned, including the impact of troop increases and decreases, and date certain deadlines." The congressional panel will also study George W. Bush's launch of the war, as well as American policy on Afghanistan in the years before the mission.
We can be rest assured it will be unperceptive, unanalytical, and unintelligent. That seems to be quite clear. The U.S. is incapable of learning. It's incapable of learning from its past mistakes. It's destined to keep on making the same mistakes over and over again.
The United States seems to be reflecting on its longest war months after the chaotic pullout. Will it learn from its long list of failures in Afghanistan?
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has officially visited the United Arab Emirates, becoming the first sitting Israeli premier to visit the Persian Gulf country. On Monday, he met with senior UAE officials, including Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. In a joint statement, the two said they discussed several areas of cooperation, including trade, technology, the environment, and tourism, as well as forming a joint research and development fund. Abu Dhabi and Tel Aviv established diplomatic relations last September under U.S. brokered agreement. That deal also saw Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco normalize their ties with Israel. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad Resistance Movement has strongly condemned the Emirati officials over receiving the Israeli Prime Minister, stressing that any normalization and alliance with the Tel Aviv regime amounts to betrayal of Palestine.
Well, you see, the monarch of the UAE, the royal family, are not really concerned about what's in the best interests of the region or of the Arab nation. They don't care about the people of the UAE, they don't care about the people of Palestine, and they don't care about the Arab, they certainly don't care about the Arab nation. So they're doing what they're doing because of how they perceive they will survive and prosper.
The trip has already drawn condemnation from the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It says the visit violates the Arab consensus that's supposed to support the Palestinian cause amid challenges imposed by Israel. Meanwhile, a member of the Palestinian Fatah Movement's Central Committee said the United Arab Emirates must be expelled from the Arab League due to normalization with Israel. The United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia have recently appeared to have changed track in their foreign policies, making overtures to nations they had previously severed ties with. Last month, the Emirati foreign minister drew the ire of the United States by meeting with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in capital Damascus. The UAE's senior national security advisor met his Iranian counterpart Ali Shamkhani and President Ibrahim Raisi in a rare visit to Iran earlier this month, a move that's said to have aimed at overcoming long-standing differences between the two sides.
They see the U.S. defeats in Afghanistan, a disorderly rout, actually. They see that the U.S. is going to have to pull out of Iraq. They see that the U.S. regime change operation has been defeated in Syria. Almost, and they see that the people of Yemen are defeating their staunch ally, Saudi Arabia. So they are like rats on a sinking ship, looking for a way to save themselves.
The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, however, is now warning that the presence of Israel in the Persian Gulf region will only lead to increased tensions as a result of the Zionist regime's Iranophobic policies. In the meantime, Iran's foreign ministry says people in West Asia have not forgotten the, quote, vicious and vindictive actions of Israel, describing the regime as the root cause of problems in the region. Iran has repeatedly called for regional efforts to maintain stability and security, while warning that external elements can't bring peace to West Asia.
The British High Court has overturned a ruling that prevented WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange from being extradited to the United States, ruling that he can be sent to the U.S. after Washington gave the court assurances that Assange's well-being would be protected were he extradited to the U.S. In January, the court rejected a previous extradition request on the grounds that moving Assange to the United States and isolating him would put him in danger of suicide. The 50-year-old Australian is wanted in the United States for disclosing confidential military and diplomatic records in 2010, which caused Washington great embarrassment. These documents included classified military and diplomatic information detailing U.S. bombing campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq, information about civilian deaths and secret U.S. drone strikes in Yemen. In face of American officials' denial, he may face up to 175 years in jail if convicted. After being locked up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for 7 years, Assange was apprehended in 2019. He was not present in court, despite his denials of any wrongdoing. He has been held at London's high-security Belmarsh prison for more than 2.5 years. During his high court appeal in October, Assange had a stroke. The stress of the ongoing U.S. court case against him, as well as a general decline in his health as he approaches his third Christmas behind bars, is said to have precipitated the stroke. Advocates for press freedom have also voiced alarm over the verdict. Reporters Without Borders is concerned about the repercussions for journalism and press freedom throughout the world. RSF also urged Washington to finally drop its long-running case against the journalist.
The U.S. is basically extraterritorializing its laws. It's saying that even if you don't live in the United States, you don't work in the United States, you're not from the United States, if you publish documents the United States doesn't like, they will come get you. And, you know, you can be threatened with 175 years in jail. And they're trying to make an example out of him to scare other people. That's the point that they're making here. At the same time, I just argue one thing. Ironically, in a sense, although Assange's case is unique, it's not unique in terms of assurances, because the United States always does this. It always lies to other countries. It lies to other judges, to other jurisdictions, in order to get people into the U.S. And, you know, whether it's through the courts or by kidnapping and rendition, which we've seen the U.S. do a lot. They just kidnap people overseas and render them they bring them to the United States. One way or another, they will find a way to get people in U.S. jurisdiction, because they know once you're there, no one is going to help you, no one is going to do anything. And that's the message they're sending here. It's that other countries need to stay in line. You need to hand over anyone we ask you to hand over. Whether it takes 10 years, 15 years, you're going to hand them over. And journalists should be scared of publishing documents the U.S. doesn't like.
It appears that the U.S. is attempting to use Assange as a fear tactic to ensure that comparable information concerning its misdeeds is not revealed again. According to Assange supporters, Washington has been discreetly manipulating events, only revealing itself when it filed an extradition request in 2019. According to them, there were several indications that the U.S. was pursuing vengeance on Assange rather than justice. The U.S.'s claims may have far-reaching ramifications for journalism's future and its capacity to hold governments accountable. The U.S. certainly wants to make sure that such a leak would not happen again. The English courts have now sparked outrage by seemingly giving permission to political persecution. Critics fear that the precedent would mean that any journalist in the U.K. or other parts of the world may now be brought to the U.S. for punishment if they cause Washington sufficient embarrassment.
I think that the U.S. is using its judicial overreach as a way to intimidate people, including journalists, including diplomats, including economic leaders of countries which are not in their favor.
The issue is that if Assange can be imprisoned for performing journalism, why can't the editors of other papers? This is undoubtedly a significant setback for journalistic freedom.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Major U.S. arms companies accounted for no less than 54% of all weapon sales of the world's 100 biggest arms suppliers in 2020, according to a new report, the latest in an annual series published by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jim Lobb, Chief of the Washington Bureau of Interpress Service from 1980 to 1985. This article is published under the heading, COVID Hardly Killed Weapons Biz, Top Companies See $513 Billion in Sales. Stay tuned for more. Major U.S. arms companies accounted for no less than 54% of all weapon sales of the world's 100 biggest arms suppliers in 2020, according to a new report, the latest in an annual series published by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. Despite pressure on many countries to divert the already strained budgets to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as the subsequent global recession, sales of arms and military services by the 100 biggest companies increased by 1.3% compared to 2019 and totaled $531 billion, according to the report. The report noted that the new total, an increase of 17% over the 2015 sales, marked the sixth year in a row of growth in arms sales. 2015 was the first year in which Chinese companies were included in what CPRIT refers to as the top 100. The industry giants, largely shielded by sustained government demand for military goods and services, according to Alexandra Markstainer, research with CPRIT Military Expenditure and Arms Production Program. In much of the world, military spending grew and some governments even accelerated payments to the arms industry in order to mitigate the economic impact of the COVID-19 crisis. As in the recent past, U.S. companies dominated the top ranks. Lockheed Martin Corp. ranked number one, followed by Raytheon Technologies, Boeing, Northrop Grumman Corp., and General Dynamics Corp. Together, those five top companies accounted for more than $180 billion in sales during 2020, or about one-third of all sales by the biggest 100 companies. 36 other U.S. companies included on the list added another $100 billion in sales, bringing the total U.S. share to $285 billion, a 1.9% increase over 2019's total. Led by British companies that together sold $37.5 billion in 2020, 26 European arms companies that made the list accounted for 21% of total arms sales, or $109 billion. That marked an increase of 6.2% over 2019. Britain's BAE Systems, which ranked sixth overall, behind the big five U.S. companies, accounted for $24 billion, or nearly two-thirds of the Europe's share, while French company arms sales actually fell by 7.7% compared to 2019, sales by the four German in the top 100 increased by 1.3% over the year, reaching nearly $9 billion, or
1.7% of total sales. Russian companies, on the other hand, suffered some of the sharpest drops in sales, in part due to delays in delivery schedules caused in major part by the pandemic. The Zionist regime was followed by the five listed Japanese companies that together sold $9.9 billion worth of military goods and services, and by the four listed South Korean firms whose combined sales came to $6.5 billion.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islamite. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. You are listening to Youth Station on IRB English Radio. And in the studio today, I have Brother Hassanain here.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
How are you, Brother Hassanain?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm good. So today, Brother Hassanain, we're going to talk about the different effects of Islam that you can see in the life. It doesn't necessarily have to be the life of people living in the West.
Right.
There's anyone in general.
Mm-hmm.
The different practices and structures that are embodied within our lifestyle from Islam.
So, Islam and our lifestyle.
Yes.
Well, I have a point over here to mention. I believe that Islam is not in our lifestyle. It should be vice versa. Our lifestyle should be Islamic.
Okay.
First of all, if we look at Islam, what's Islam? Islam is a religion. It's a deen, right? It's a way of living life as per Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Okay, so what you're saying is you have to live your life within these parameters.
Exactly.
And a religion sets those parameters for you.
Exactly.
Okay.
Because Allah has sent us and He had made the perfect religion for us, Islam. So, you know, there's nothing like, you know, non-Islamic lifestyle. Like either you follow Islam, you're within the parameters, mm-hmm. or you're out of it, or you cross the boundaries.
Okay.
Like if you're Muslim, there's nothing like Islamic lifestyle, non-Islamic lifestyle.
Uh-huh.
If you talk about non-Islamic...
Oh, so you can't split it up as, okay, look, one day I'm going to be Islamic and the other day
exactly,
I'm
not. Exactly, right? Like, if you say that, okay, I'm living non-Islamic lifestyle, there's nothing like non-Islamic lifestyle. We call it in Sharia, haram.
Mm.
This Islamic lifestyle, like, within the parameters, within the boundaries that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has set for us.
Uh-huh.
So deen, as I said, is a way of living life.
So where can someone find these parameters, per se?
We believe that, you know, these parameters are a set of religious values, right? These are the beliefs, norms, thoughts, and different, you know, patterns which are formed based on Quranic and Ahlul Bayt teachings.
Okay.
You get it from Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam and Quran.
Within the Quran and within the sayings and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, you find these parameters. They've set them. So now suppose someone who's living in the West,
right?
They're not in that Islamic background. So I'm talking about a Muslim who's living in an area that isn't Islamic,
mm-hmm.
right? You don't have, suppose, say in the East, say in the Middle East, suppose.
Right.
You're in a country where they recite the Adhan, right? For every prayer.
Yeah.
So you know it's, okay, it's the time for prayer, right?
Right.
They have places for you to do wudu or ablution
mm-hmm.
before you pray.
Right.
But like in the West, how does someone find those parameters and stick to those parameters in the West, where it's an area where they're going against Islam, right? In mm-hmm. some cases, they're completely trying to rid that area of Islam. It's not just getting to know the parameters, but it's, look, understanding what they are and living by those parameters. It's two different things, right?
Yeah.
So you said you could get
like
the parameters through Quran and the sayings of the Ahlul Bayt,
right?
How does someone live through that in an area that's completely against Islam?
what does he have to do with the area he's living in?
Say it's an area where it's preventing him to live his life through those parameters. What is he supposed to do? When Muslims, right, when we are born, there are different customs that we have. Suppose when a child is born, the adhan and the iqamat are read in their ears.
Right.
Right? There is, suppose, a sacrifice given of an animal.
Right.
And you bring in other believers to celebrate the auspicious occasion of the birth of a child.
Right.
Right? Okay, Brother Hassanin, I have more examples, but let's take a short break and then we'll come back to continue this.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So, welcome back. I have Brother Hassanain here with me in the studio, and we were talking about the parameters of Islam, and specifically how one can live their life through these parameters in an area that might be against Islam.
Right, so we were discussing about Islamic parameters, right? So we said that Islamic parameters are the norms that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has set for us. So as mentioned before, we can find these norms from Quran and the teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. So if you say, like, you know, what are the boundaries, if we talk about, you can say that, you know, the halal and haram are the boundaries. Like in Sharia, you get five different things, like halal, haram, wajib, mustahab, and mubah. So these are the parameters. If you are living, if you're observing these, if you're abiding by these norms, you're basically living an Islamic lifestyle. You're not going against the laws of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If you're going against the laws, you're crossing the boundaries. And your lifestyle is shifting from the Islamic lifestyle.
So you got to have that Islamic point of view while you're living.
Exactly.
Your life.
You know, the performing of the wajibah, like praying salah, that's Islamic lifestyle. You're doing something mubah. I believe is you're not. You're still following the Islamic lifestyle. It's nothing out of Islam.
Can you explain mubah to our listeners who might not know what it means?
Neither wajib nor haram.
So it's not a compulsory act, but it's also not something that can be held against you.
Exactly. Like, you know, just sitting idle, you know, raising your hand. You know, it's not, you
so
have
just typical actions.
Exactly. Okay. That's mubah. So, you know, if you're abiding by these laws or the norms, you're following an Islamic lifestyle. You ask me, where can we see Islam in our lifestyle?
Yeah.
So, you know, apart from these, if you want to pick out something where you can say this is Islamic, you know, point out something.
So, for example, suppose I want to live in an Islamic lifestyle, but where I'm living isn't allowing me to do that. What do I do in that situation? For example, in France, they banned hijab, right? One's covering. Now, when a child becomes baligh, right? They reach that age of maturity.
Right.
Again, the age differs for boys and girls. For girls, it's typically 9 years old.
Yeah.
And for boys, it can be anywhere from 13 to 15.
15, yeah.
Right? Now, for a girl, the second she reaches this age of maturity, she has to cover herself from those who she isn't related to some extent, right?
Right.
Where it's her immediate family, her parents, her siblings, you know, that's fine. She doesn't have to cover herself there. But suppose strangers, to the extent even cousins are considered strangers.
Non-mahram.
Exactly, non-mahram. I was just trying to explain the concept of mahram and non-mahram to our listeners who didn't know what those two words meant, right? So now, again, we will continue with these two phrases, right? So mahram are those, suppose, those individuals who are in your immediate family that you don't need to cover from.
Right.
Non-mahram are strangers. To the extent even your cousins are considered non-mahram, where, look, you have to cover yourself.
Yeah, but my cousin is not stranger to me.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's strangers, and to the extent even cousins are included in this group of non-mahram
right?
So now suppose, for example, this girl wants to, you know, live according to the Islamic parameters.
Right.
Right? She lives, suppose, in France, where they've passed a law that anyone under the age of 18 can't wear a headscarf. Right? But now it's compulsory on her to wear a headscarf after the age of 9.
Right.
And in some instances, they say for them to practice this concept of wearing a headscarf, you start a couple years earlier. Right? So they get accustomed to that way of dressing, right? They're used to it. It's not something just brand new sprung upon them, right? She's trying to live by those guidelines, but the area she lives in is preventing her to do that.
Yeah, for this, I guess we need to ask our Maharaja, our scholars, what do they say about this? Because, you know, I don't really want to say anything because I'm not expert in this issue. Over here, we need to ask our Maharaja, what do they suggest, like someone living in France? Okay, you know, you might say that, okay, those women, they shouldn't leave their houses. But that's not possible, right? If someone has to go to school.
Exactly.
So we need to ask our...
stay at home all day?
Yeah, we need to ask our Maharaja.
Okay.
So apart from this, when you're talking about, you know, where can we find Islam in our lifestyle, all these things are there, halal, wajib, haram. If we leave these things aside, in a small things, we can find Islam. When a baby is born, what do? You recite Adhan in his ears. Mm-hmm. You take ghusl and you pray, taking wudu. Mm-hmm. You know, these are the things where even non-Muslims can find
so
Islam in your lifestyle.
It's not something far-fetched. It's not something completely out of the bounds of, like, typical living.
Right.
So you're saying over here that I can live within those parameters with people who aren't Muslims or who don't have the Islamic point of view, per se, in their life.
Uh-huh, yeah.
It's not just only Muslims who pray. We have Christians who pray.
Yeah.
We have Jews who pray. Mm-hmm. We have different other sects and different other religions that pray.
Right.
Right? So me praying shouldn't be that much of an obstacle living in an area, suppose like the West, against Islam.
Obstacle to whom?
To those who are living there.
In what sense will you be an
obstacle? As in, suppose you're living in a country that's against Islam.
Uh-huh.
They don't want Islam to spread within their country to such an extent, right?
Yeah.
So they will try to minimize any Islamic push.
Activity.
Exactly. Whether it be an activity, whether it be demonstrations, whether it be, in a sense, opening the public's eyes to the real, true Islam that the Prophet brought.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Not the, you know, this is our version of Islam and this is all you need to know.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The true Islam.
Yeah.
Living within the parameters of Islam, having this point of view of Islam, does that only benefit us, or does it have an effect on the society as well?
We following the Islamic lifestyle, you say?
Yeah,
of course it has a good effect on others, right? If you're really following the Islamic lifestyle, if you're really following the parameters, and if we are really abiding ourselves to the teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. Ahlul Bayt, if you study about them, what was the position of Ahlul Bayt in this world? They had the position of wilayat, which is above everything. They had everything.
Can you explain wilayat to our listeners?
Wilayat is, having authority upon us, which is, you know, this authority is given to Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So over here, they had everything, right? But still, they chose to serve people.
So in a sense,
Imam Ali alayhi salam used to take loaves of bread on his shoulder, and he used to roam around the streets of Kufa and feed children and feed orphans. If you really abide by these teachings, don't you think it's a betterment of society in that?
Exactly. It's for people in general.
Right.
Right? Being good, talking, I guess, in a sense, softly with one another. You're not screaming at each other's faces, right?
Okay, the norms we're talking about, that we have to, you know, follow these norms. We don't have to cross them. Like, what are the norms? Like, you know, what's haram? Drinking alcohol. That's haram. Adultery is haram.
Yeah.
It's connected to the society, right?
Exactly. Even if we look at the inner meanings of those, right?
Uh-huh.
Drinking. Now, obviously, some religions say there's no issue. But if you really look at it, you're harming yourself while you're drinking.
Exactly.
Right? At the end of the day, Islam has prevented these things for a reason. There is an underlying reason behind all of these.
Like,
right?
Islam has stopped us from backbiting and all.
Exactly.
It's not just related to, like, ourselves, like, personally, right? It's about the development of society, the betterment of society.
Okay. So now you're saying these parameters that one should live by. When should you start doing this? When should you start applying this, say, not just for yourself, but suppose for your family as well? Say right now, suppose in the future, you're going to get married, you're going to have kids. When do you want to let them know about this? When do you want to, I guess, in a sense, where we say...
Are you talking about when should our young children know about this?
Exactly. When should we apply this concept to them?
Look, now we should apply this concept. Like, we should teach them, you know, a few years before them getting Baligh. Before they reach the age of puberty. Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, you should make them aware of this.
Uh-huh. So don't, like, just throw the burden upon them. Slowly integrate it into their lives.
If you're asking about when should we apply these norms or when we should acquire this lifestyle, as I said before, there's no time where you're not acquiring this lifestyle. As I said before, Islam is not in our lifestyle, but our lifestyle is Islamic.
Uh-huh.
That's all right. So it's nothing like, you know, acquiring it or leaving it.
Uh-huh. So we live our life through the lens of Islam here.
Exactly. So when do you, apply this and teach our children? Before them getting baligh, before they're reaching to the age of puberty.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining me today,
my
brother Hassanain. I will end the program here with a hadith from the Holy Prophet. He says, learning something during one's youth is like engraving in stone, and learning something when one is old is writing it on the surface of water. Right? So with this hadith that we hear the Prophet telling us, that if you understand these parameters of Islam that we've just talked about in this session, understanding and applying these parameters towards our children, towards the youth, at a younger age, will solidify those practices within them. Compared to teaching someone who is older, who's already used to a lifestyle. It's just like riding on the surface of water. It'll be there for a second, and it'll be gone the second the next wave comes by. Thank you for joining us today, and inshallah, we will see you in the next session.
On Tuesday, December 13th, the U.S. reached a grim pandemic milestone. 800,000 people have died of COVID-19 since the pandemic hit the country last year. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Sharon Jung, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Passes Another Unfathomable COVID Milestone, Reaching 800,000 Deaths. Stay tuned for more. On Tuesday, December 13th, the U.S. reached the grim pandemic milestone. 800,000 people have died of COVID-19 since the pandemic hit the country last year. In the initial month of the pandemic, when the U.S. surpassed an already towering 100,000 deaths, the New York Times dedicated the front page of their May 24, 2020 paper to publishing every deceased person's name with a brief description of their personalities with the headline, "An Incalculable Loss." At the time, readers described the dedication as heart-wrenching. The U.S. would double that figure, however, hitting 200,000 deaths in September 2020. States began easing pandemic restrictions in spite of public health officials' warnings, just as masking became widespread to contain the virus. By then, President Donald Trump had baselessly said many times that the pandemic wasn't bad in the U.S. compared to other countries. It was, and that it was turning around soon. It didn't. Public health figures worried that people would begin becoming numb to the loss. With 800,000 deaths, four times the September 2020 mark, more people have died from COVID-19 than the total number of people who died in the American Civil War. It is, on average, over 2 years, orders of magnitude higher than the deaths due to common causes like car crashes or the flu. It is another dark milestone that marks the U.S. decimal response to the pandemic. In September 2021, with approximately 660,000 deaths, about 1 in 500 Americans had died from the virus. Now, that number is closer to 1 in 400. This new landmark, as compiled by Johns Hopkins University, comes as the U.S. is once again experiencing a surge of cases. High vaccination rates and re-implemented mask mandates had driven down case rates this summer. But as more of the population became vaccinated, with about 17% of Americans still having not received a single dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, cases began rising again in the fall, this time driven by the Delta variant and now the Omicron variant. Despite the U.S. vaccine drive over the past year, most of those deaths have occurred this year. The gap between vaccination rates between counties that went for Trump in 2020 and counties that went for Joe Biden, meanwhile, is growing ever wider. Researchers have estimated that over 160,000 of the deaths that have occurred since June were preventable if vaccine holdouts had gone under jabs. Biden encouraged Americans to get their shots, marking the tragic milestone. I urge all Americans, do your patriotic duty to keep our country safe, to protect yourself and those around you, and to honor the memory of all those we have lost, the president said. As the mere and more transmissible Omicron spreads in the United States of America, health experts are concerned that behavior during winter holidays will cause yet another spike in cases. Last year's winter holidays were followed by a spike in the daily average of new cases to over 250,000. The United States is seeing another rise in cases now weeks after Thanksgiving. Of the people who have been infected with Omicron, many of the cases have been mild so far. But many of the cases have also been of unvaccinated people. Research has suggested that receiving a booster shot could help vaccinated people from contracting the variant. With no end in sight to the pandemic, some health experts are predicting that the United States will inevitably reach 1 million COVID deaths. One study estimated that the U.S. is closer to that milestone than official counts would suggest, with 100,000 COVID deaths unaccounted due to reporting challenges. 1 million deaths isn't a milestone that has to be reached. Indeed, countries with higher vaccination rates aren't seeing nearly as many cases, showing that more deaths are preventable.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality, youth, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, culture, politics, all produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Besides defending geographical borders, martyrs defend religious, spiritual, and cultural borders.
This is part of the speech delivered on November 21st, 2021, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials in charge of conducting the Martyrs of Elam commemoration ceremony.
یکی از خصوصیات دیگر ایلام حضور همه جانبه همه قشرا بود تا از عالم برجسته فاضل اونجا مرحوم آشق عبدالرحمن حیدری رحمت الله علیه که در نیمکم با ما بود بنده اون بالا ایشونم مرحوم آشق عبدالرحمن چند بار بنده آمدم چه قبل از ریاست جمهوری چه بعد از اون
Another characteristic of Elam was the wholehearted presence of people from all social backgrounds, from scholars to the common people. For instance, the late Sheikh Abdul Rahman Haydari, may God's mercy be upon him, was with me on the Maymak Hills. He was with me at the top of that summit. He was with me everywhere I went. I visited Elam several times, both before and after my presidency. He was always present in the field of battle as long as he was alive. He would take his gun and was ready to fight at all times in the true sense of the word. The same is true of the common people and the numerous tribes in Elam. Those who could fight were present in the field and the masses of the people helped in the resistance. One of the gentlemen in the meeting stated that the people did not leave the city. I myself saw this with my own eyes in the city of Elam. The enemy planes would regularly strike the city repeatedly. In those times, no one would remain on the streets and the people would go to one of the deserts or forests around the city. After the bombardment had finished, they would go back to the city. That is, this way of leaving and coming back to the city had become a routine activity for the people. But they never completely left the city or the province, and they stood firm.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
خب وقت در زیر همین بمباران هاست در همین شرایط سخت است که یک نخبه نابغه‌ای مثل شهید رضایی نژاد تربیت میشه.
It was during the time of those bombardments and in that difficult situation that a genius, namely Martyr Rezai Nejad, grew up. Martyr Rezai Nejad was a nuclear scientist who was martyred. His scientific importance was so immense that the enemy felt his existence would help the Islamic Republic progress, and so they assassinated him. They martyred him in front of his wife and small daughter. That young scientist had spent his youth witnessing those bombardments and those difficult circumstances in Elam.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me. You've done
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
On Thursday, the UN General Assembly passed a resolution on the situation of human rights in Iran. Pushed by Canada, the resolution expresses serious concern over, quote, alarmingly high rate of the imposition of death penalty in Iran, including those against child offenders. 76 countries voted in favor of the resolution, and 31 countries voted against it, while 69 others abstained. Iran's High Council for Human Rights was quick to deplore what he called a politically motivated measure replete with factual errors.
There is no international rule that bans the death penalty for people under 18. Furthermore, Article 1 of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child defines a child as every human being below the age of 18 years, unless the national law considers majority attained at an earlier age. Well, in the Islamic Republic, a child has a different definition. So it's not illegal in Iran to execute a person under 18. Yet I should add that the number of minus 18 people who receive death penalty in Iran is insignificant.
Tehran views the new resolution as a clear example of double standards at the United Nations. The Islamic Republic urged the international body to open its eyes to the devastating effects of U.S. sanctions on the health sector in Iran. Tehran says those sanctions have denied thousands of Iranians access to life-saving medicine.
Iran is the major victim of sanctions. The United States has admitted that it has put in place an unprecedented sanctions against Iran. Isn't this a violation of human rights? Then why has the UN stopped short of condemning the illegal and unilateral sanctions on the Iranian nation? If you are so concerned about the rights of few prisoners who have committed crimes against the Iranian nation, you also need to take into account the rights of millions of Iranians who cannot access medical supplies just because of the sanctions.
Tehran also referred the UN to Canada's track record of rights abuse against the Aboriginal people, particularly disproportionate violence against indigenous women. Tehran said these are manifestations of deep-rooted colonialism, which Canada has been practicing with impunity. The Islamic Republic called on the UN to avoid a selective approach toward human rights. It said dialogue and cooperation based on mutual respect and equal footing is the only way to ensure the promotion and protection of human rights at the international level.
The Islamic Republic regards itself as a major victim of rights violation, many of which, it says, were committed by the proponents of the recent anti-Iran resolution. So Tehran says those countries are in no position to lecture others on human rights, and such resolutions will only kill the chance for constructive dialogues. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Alarm bells have rung across Britain after a Conservative MP informed pro-Israel activists of new government plans to outlaw the pro-Palestine boycott, divestment and sanctions movement. The comments were said by British lawmaker Robert Jenrick during an online conference about anti-Semitism titled "Why Do So Many People Hate Jews?"
It is, I think, becoming much more of a fringe activity. What we want to do is pass a piece of legislation here, and I'm pretty confident it will be in the next legislative programme, the Queen's Speech, as we call it.
Since 2005, the boycott campaign, also known as BDS, has sought to sanction all Israeli-made products produced on illegally occupied Palestinian lands. The movement has been so successful in causing economic damage to Israel that pro-Israel groups have branded the BDS an existential threat and attempted to smear its supporters as anti-Semitic.
It's a shocking decision from the humanitarian point of view, where once again the British government is standing by the oppressor, is standing by the occupier, is standing by the criminal against the victim. It's something that it doesn't surprise, but it shocks us to the how tone deaf this government is. I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever that if anything, this government has stupidly, foolishly, ridiculously, has actually afforded far more credit to BDS than it could ever have imagined.
This development would be just the latest example of a long line of attacks that this government has carried out against Palestine solidarity activism since it came into power. If they go ahead with these plans next year, then we can expect to see large-scale protest and condemnation action taking place from the many supporters of the Palestinian cause up and down the country. Robert Carter, London.
France has withdrawn from northern Mali and the historic city of Timbuktu 9 years after launching a war without the initial approval of the United Nations or even French Parliament. Mali initially became destabilized in 2011 following France's illegal arms drops to anti-Gaddafi militants in Libya. The arms were then used by Tuareg separatists who have demanded more rights ever since colonial France first dictated Mali's peculiar bow tie-shaped borders. The war caused several thousand deaths and more than 1 million people to flee their homes. There have been 2 military coups in little over a year, while increasing demonstrations against France's presence could no longer be ignored or sufficiently repressed.
It's very difficult for France to justify its presence, even more so because the people of Mali, who are neither Tuareg nor Islamists, have been protesting France's presence in the country. So what the Malians want is not really very clear, except the fact that they want the French gone.
The war has been so ineffectual that Malians openly accuse France of arming the rebels, while the conflict is often dubbed France's Afghanistan. Paris has blamed Russian disinformation for turning Malian public opinion against France, but polls in the capital, Bamako, have shown that 80% of respondents believe that France is only in Mali to defend French interests.
France's failed war in Mali has been even more degrading to its image at home and abroad than their failed involvement in Afghanistan. The war has been routinely cited by terrorists as justification for attacks in France.
France has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa since 1960, when many of their former colonies gained nominal independence. Mali remains among the poorest countries in the world, but that's not due to a lack of natural resources.
It's believed that Mali has some very important resources that have yet to be tapped, like neighboring Niger, which is rich in uranium. And once again, let's not forget, France gets nearly 80% of its energy from nuclear power. So uranium is an important asset for the French. But it would be difficult for France to say, yeah, we're going to stay in Mali because there's this potential uranium deposit, plus the gold, plus this, plus that, etc.
Analysts say that it's premature to call it the end of the war, but that France is entering into a new phase of the war. France will retain a 3,000-strong army to roam the Sahel region. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki says the Islamic movement aims to raise awareness about Islam. He says malevolent intent is behind the allegations that the IMN is an association. He asked the media to stop referring to his supporters as if they are members of an organization, explaining that they are just activists.
We don't have membership card, right? You don't register to become part of Islam. Once you are active, you are just active. That's all. It's open for all Muslims, not only Muslims. It is open even to non-Muslims. You may know that, maybe you don't know. That is Christian forum of the Islamic movement. What happened?
Sheikh Zazaki said many Nigerians have marked the 6th anniversary of the December 2015 Zaria massacre, where hundreds of his supporters